Well, hello again and a very warm welcome to this, the Parish Council, the Rocking Vicars official podcast. And here we are once again, and we're glad you could join us. With me, as always, is Terence DeCom.
Hello, Magnus.
Hello. How you doing?
Now, it's funny you should ask that.
Yes.
I'm a bit traumatised, is the truth.
Oh, no, you don't say.
Yes, it's a historical trauma.
A historical trauma?
Historical.
It's a medieval knight's been chasing you through the Berkshire countryside?
Actually, I don't talk like that because I do have dreams like that. I have really strange dreams.
Really? And funny you should say that because our emailer, the Rocky Vicar emailer this week, is dream-based.
Is it indeed? Mm. Oh, no. I might have to read it through my fingers because I only remember my weird dreams. I don't remember any cheerful dreams.
No, of course, yeah.
And I have a couple of recurring dreams as well. I'll tell you about that another time.
I can hardly wait. Yeah.
Well, that's the other thing, isn't it? When people tell you about their dreams, they're incredibly important to them, but to anybody else, it's kind of, oh, really? You know.
Yes, and there's always a problem if you have dreamt of a female friend or a colleague in completely innocent terms. You know, they've just popped up in your dream. The next day, there's always a problem saying to them, "I had a dream about you last night." Because the image that appears in their head of what you're about to tell them is often far from the truth, and then you wish you'd never said it. Yeah.
50 years ago, I'm going to take you back in time, 50 years ago.
Good Lord.
The middle of June is always a difficult kind of time for me because...
Was this shortly after your birth, by the way?
It was.
Yeah, okay.
It was stress. I was 47 at the time. No. It's an incident that happened 50 years ago that still haunts me. And, I was coming up to the end of my first year at Our Lady of the Rosary Preparatory School.
Okay.
And so I had been just five. And it was my classmate, Margaret Meany's birthday. You see, I can even remember her name to this day, this incident.
Yes, and a good Irish name, to be sure.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Well, it was a Catholic prep school, so, you know. Now, the circus was in town.
Oh.
And And as a treat, Mrs. Meany decided to take Margaret and a group of her school chums, including me, to the circus.
Yes.
Ideal birthday treat, you would have thought. So after school, we all went along to Shortwood Common, just by Staines there, and I could still picture the big top, and there was all your excitement mounting, and we saw the horses and the jugglers and trapeze artists and the acrobats.
Yes.
And then came the finale. Oh, dear, I'm beginning to just hyperventilate a bit.
It wasn't Freddy in the Dreamers, was it?
It wasn't Freddy in the Dreamers. Very good, very good. For the finale, in came the clowns in their car. You're one step ahead. And, the bits of the car falling off as they drove around the ring, as it traditionally does, you know, the collapsing car.
Yes.
Anyway, from the back of the car, they pulled out this huge blackboard.
Okay,
And set it up in the ring.
Mm-hmm.
And looked for a little boy in the front row to help them with a mathematical problem. And that little 5-year-old was me, Magnus. You're probably, again, one step ahead. And they pulled me out into the centre of the ring.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, very much under the spotlight, literally in the circus ring.
Yeah.
And on the blackboard, pre-written in very big chalk letters, was the sum 2 + 2 = And so they asked me, you know, a little boy, do you know the answer? And so I said, yes, I was 5 years old. Yes, four, I said, 2 + 2 = 4. 5? They shouted to the crowd in disbelief. And no, sir, 4. You know, I was sort of exclaiming at this point, 4?
Yes, yes.
5, said the clowns. It's 5. He's saying it's 5. And
this is like a Michael Barrymore gig, isn't it?
yes, actually. Funnily enough, because they sort of then chased me out of the ring, waving a rolled up copy of the Evening Standard. I remember the details so clearly. It really was the Evening Standard.
Were they short on props? Or?
I probably they were sitting around half an hour earlier looking at the racing results. That's all I can.
Yes.
But then with me still, but I said four. Then the music came up, and the lights came on, and the show was over. And it was just left for Mrs. Meany to take us home.
Yes.
And all the way, I was going, but I said four. And I kept repeating this, and everyone else's focus was on, of course, the impending jelly and ice cream.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And those bloody clowns. I'll tell you what, you know, I've hated clowns ever since. I really have. They, right through Charlie Caroli,
yes,
and Krusty the Clown, and of course the Friedmans, you know, everything I've ever seen with clowns ever since is just, well, it's darkened my life, Magnus.
If it's any consolation, it does mean you now have something in common with P. Diddy.
Do I?
Yeah, he's clown phobic.
Oh, well, me and Diddy, we're soul brothers on that front.
Yeah.
I really do. I can't watch programs with clowns in. All of those kind of, that side of the arts always disturbs me a little bit. I don't really like magicians either. I find them a bit spooky.
Yeah, yeah. Magicians tend to vary wildly, don't they? I think the ones I like are the ones where they just get something simple out of their pocket, you know, a nut and a bolt or a playing card or something of that nature, and then do something extraordinary. I think that is always entertaining. When my heart sinks when they introduce a magician and he wheels on about 400 weight of plywood painted in glitter and fluorescent colours and it fills a tank with water and brings some padlocks and chains and some fireworks. And I think whatever he's going to do, it's too complicated, you know. It's too much, and there's too much scope for him to have rigged all this stuff up, and it's all too much of a fuss for me to then get excited about the fact that his assistant is going to look like she's drowning and then appear at the back of the theatre or whatever. But if somebody can just pull something out of their pocket, a cigarette or whatever, and do something illusionary with it, that's always good, I think, yeah.
Yeah, sort of like close-up magic.
Yeah, yeah, I like that. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, yeah.
The other bit on magicians, especially the old-school magicians, well, they've always got something of the kind of creepy uncle about them as well.
Oh, yes, yes, yeah.
You know, come and sit on my knee, little boy. You know, there's a bit element of that to it as well, which tends to sort of freak me out a bit.
There is, and you always wonder what their intentions to their glamorous female assistant are. There's an element of that as well.
They usually end up marrying them, I think.
Yeah, yeah, but I think before we start naming names, I think we know who we're alluding to. Was it to Dennis Pennis who once asked the lady to whom we're referring what first attracted you to the multimillionaire?
Yes, it was Mrs. Merton.
Was it Mrs. Merton? That's right. Was Mrs. Merton. Yes, yeah, terrific, terrific. Well, I'm sorry you feel so bad about clowns. Now, this will freak you out, and you can believe me or not believe me, it is entirely your choice, but last night I dreamt about chalk and blackboards.
That is odd, isn't it?
I really did, yes. Yeah, no clowns, but, I was in a meeting room, and I was trying to show somebody something, and there was a big blackboard, and I kept reaching into the sort of tray, the runner in front of the blackboard. Yeah. Everything I pulled out wasn't chalk. It wouldn't write on the board.
Anxiety.
No, it was, very much so, yes. Ill-prepared for...
awful. And they're so real, aren't they?
They are. Ugh. Yeah, but it's funny, it would have been a blackboard and chalk, and now you've just said that is very odd. Yes, yeah. Carl Jung would have said, of course, that's not odd at all. That's part of a collective subconscious, wouldn't he?
Yes, absolutely. He would have done, but I wouldn't have understood.
And I'm only pretending to.
Yeah.
So I've been listening to Radio 2 this week, which isn't unusual in itself, Terence, but something struck me. Radio 2 have an unnatural and unhealthy relationship with one Jamie Cullum. Now, is this just me?
No, they've got a fixation on the fellow. Yeah,
they are fixated with Jamie Cullum. And I can't think of one good reason why that would be.
Well, I call it the Gambaccini solution, and I'll explain why.
Whatever the explanation, it's a fantastic turn of phrase and must be the title of your first novel.
It would be embossed in gold, on raised gold on the front of my novel.
It was Terence Dacom's groundbreaking first tome, The Gambaccini Solution.
Because people often ask why Paul Gambaccini is always popping up on screen when a rock musician dies or is in the news for some scrape that they've got into, some scandal or that. Okay. And, you know, people say, well, why is it always Gambo? And this is why Jamie Cullum comes under this heading as well. It's the reliability factor. Mm-hmm. With Gambaccini, he's articulate, can think on his feet, is usually quotable, and not averse to saying something controversial.
Okay.
But most importantly, he won't swear. And he lives in London and can jump in an Addison Lee and be in White City or Isleworth inside 30 minutes.
Yes. Okay.
And this is Jamie Cullum fits into that Gambaccini solution, that sort of Radio 2 profile perfectly.
Yeah, okay. So he's the go-to guy for what, all things jazzular, is he?
Well, he can span the network.
Yeah.
I mean, he's only, let's see, about early 30s, I think. So he can go from...
Early 30s? Only about 14, isn't he?
Yeah, unfortunately, he does look that. Especially as he's married, his wife is about sort of 8 inches taller.
She is, yeah.
No, I mean, he can go across from Chris Evans through to Simon Mayo, and even actually to the older presenters, the sort of... although he's not on Radio 2 anymore, the sort of Michael Parkinson generation,
right,
if you like.
Yeah.
But the most important thing, he's got compliance coursing through his
hands. He's what they tend to refer to as a safe pair of hands, then, is he?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. I mean, exactly. He fits the Gambaccini rule perfectly. He's reliable, again, won't swear, safe, articulate, quotable, flexible. A sort of everyman for Radio 2, and I think the added bonus is, of course, he won't leave messages on Andrew Sachs's answering service.
No, he probably won't. But I just think, and I do think there's something of a conflict of interest, because, of course, the guy markets, promotes, records, records. And I think, obviously, that there is he doesn't go on air and say, buy my record. But there's a promotional element between his recorded output and the shows he puts on Radio 2, surely.
Well, I think the days when the BBC used to worry about those things, oddly considering the compliance issue, have long gone. They used to have these rules, didn't they, where you couldn't mention a commercial product on air.
Yeah.
And to this day, people still, particularly people... kind of newish to broadcasting, tend to turn up on a BBC show. A guest will say, "Yes, and I just had a glass of Pepsi Cola," and then they go, "Am I allowed to say
that's
that?"
That's right. Yes.
And then sort of the broadcaster will reassure them, "Yes, of course you can." And you know, I think those days have gone. And I mean, Radio 2 in particular has a crossover with many of their presenters having worlds outside Broadcasting House or White City.
So I think the time when you couldn't mention branded goods or events on television was probably, you know, the 70s, early 80s. So perhaps you can fill me in on this, because I was thinking about this the other day. Do you recall at the end of variety shows or even sitcoms in the 70s, the credits would be rolling with the typography with that rather funny, fuzzy edge that they used to have before they could properly superimpose text over screen. And a voiceover would come on and it would say, "Terry Scott is now appearing in Run For Your Wife at the Vaudeville Theatre, London's West End." What was that? How did that happen? Was that a thing with the agents? You can only have my guy if you... Can you remember that happening?
I do... Now you mention it, I do have a vague memory of that, but was that on ITV?
No,
or was that,
no,
that was on BBC.
It was very much a BBC habit. In fact, I don't recall it ever happening on ITV.
That's a very good point, and I only recall it now you mention it, and I haven't got a great insight into that, because it slipped from my mind at all. But you're right, that was a voiceover, they did say that. And yet, when you think at the same time, as this was going on, that you had, for example, the Kinks had to re-record Lola, and where it said Coca-Cola, they had to change the lyrics to Cherry Cola in the lyrics of that same song.
Yes, yes,
and,
yes.
And I also remember there was a series that predated That's Life with Esther Ranson. I can't remember what it was called, but this would have been late 60s. And it had Bernard Braden in it as the sort of Esther Ranson figure. And he had to leave the BBC, if I remember, because he took a gig doing an advert on ITV for butter or spread or something. Okay. So there was a time when these things were hugely important, but clearly not now. I mean, you'd think about only about 2 years ago, wasn't it, when the BBC went nuts when U2 had a new album out, and that, you know, it was promoted all over the place. They did a gig on the top of Broadcasting House.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah, you know, and BBC Two was called BBC U2 for an evening or something, wasn't it? Mm. Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, clearly there's been a sea change there of what you can and cannot promote. But yeah, I do remember these voiceovers. So, particularly on a Saturday night, you know, Leslie Crowther is now appearing in Babes in the Wood in Coventry or something.
It must have been in the contract, as you say, that our man will host Saturday night at the Blackpool Tower, as long as you mention this in the credits.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Okay, well, that's good. I now understand why BBC Radio 2 is so in love with Jamie Cullum, and they might as well go the whole hog, haven't they, and say Jamie Cullum is now recording tedious Radiohead jazz cover versions for your pleasure, please go and buy, and then the circle would be complete then. Yeah, yes.
Yeah, right.
Do you recall the band Erasure, Terence?
I do.
Of course.
Yes. Yeah. Vince Clarke and Andy Bell, and Vince from Depeche Mode.
Yeah, and Yazoo, yes, and the Assembly, or the Assembly were a band in between, I think, yeah.
It was a brief project, wasn't
it? That's right. So, as is often the way with these things, I was scrolling through my non-branded MP3 player on the train and landed on a load of Erasure stuff. I said, do you know what, for this particular train journey, I'm going to do the Erasure back catalogue, which I did, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. They really had a knack of nailing those synth-pop tunes for, a run of 7 or 8 years, didn't they? Or maybe even more. They're particularly good at it, and I thought, so what the hell happened to Erasure? They had everything going for them. You know, they were recognisable, two guys. You had the quiet keyboard guy and the flamboyant frontman a la Pet Shop Boys. And they had the tunes and the hits and all the rest of it, and then just seemed to fade away to nothing. So I thought, well, you know, this is one to ask Sir Terence, him the font of all pop knowledge. And, of course, since then, the flippers have popped up all over the place. I can't move.
You can't move without Erasure.
Erasure. But I was going to ask you what happened to them, but various appearances have gone some way to answer that. But can you add anything to...
Well, I mean, I think they're a good example of the sort of modern age of keeping a career going in a dwindling market.
Yeah.
Because, first of all, they've got a very loyal fan base, who have, you know, stick with them. And Andy Bell, who you mentioned, something of a icon for his take on certain issues, particularly gay issues.
Yeah.
And therefore, perhaps because of that, and bearing in mind the loyalty of their following, they're currently in the middle of a very big world tour.
Yeah.
27 dates in America, from Tampa across to Seattle, and a new album, as you probably learned as well, coming out to coincide with a tour coming out in the autumn over here, called Tomorrow's World. So it's that market now where you're pretty much reliant on live aspects for your career.
Yeah.
Less so with recorded. It'd be interesting to see how the album does. I suspect, I could be wrong, I suspect probably not very well. But as I say, if you want to tour every couple of years, bring something a little bit different to it, and just go where your fans are, I think that, you know, you can still maintain the lifestyle to which you have become accustomed.
Yeah, and I must just say, Tomorrow's World's a fantastic title for an album. Some amazing nobody's done that before. I guess what they've done is plateaued, isn't it? They've dropped a few notches and plateaued, but can still maintain that particular level. Almost immediately I thought, I wonder whatever happened to Erasure. Andy Bell crops up on Pop Star to Opera Star.
Oh, does he?
Yeah, on ITV, which is running at the moment. I haven't seen any of it, but that answered where is Andy Bell question for me. And then on the web radio station that I'm doing some work on, one of the presenters announces that that very evening, Erasure are playing in Sherwood Forest, close to Nottingham. So I thought, oh, hold on. All the answers are sort of coming out of the collective subconscious now to give me the answers. So they are clearly out there. And as you say, doing a world tour and playing coast to coast in the States. But they've never managed to quite resurrect themselves in the way that their contemporaries, the Pet Shop Boys, have they? They're a bit under the radar still, aren't they?
They are. I think, I suspect they're bigger in America than they are here.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, it's unusual, but I think, again, because of the sort of Andy Bell motif, he really is, a figurehead in the gay community,
right,
to be fair.
Right,
so...
Yeah.
I think that sustains a lot of their and they probably had a lot of success in America.
Right.
But I've got a sort of interesting aspect though about the other one in Erasure, Vince Clarke, that we were talking about earlier. I live in Berkshire, and I'm on the edge between Berkshire and Surrey, mm-hmm. and I went to school in Chertsey, and there's a little kind of village, I suppose one would say, just between where I am and that sort of side of Surrey, called St Anne's Hill. And it's only a small area, but it's an area of very sort of wealthy people with big houses, mm-hmm. It's pretty much a private estate.
The stockbroker belt, I think they'd once call it, wouldn't they?
That's it. That's what I was struggling to come up with a description. You've nailed it. Yep. Yeah. Anyway, there's this house on St Anne's Hill, and it was owned in the 1960s by Keith Moon.
Oh, right.
And it was called Tara then.
That rings a bell, yes.
Yeah. And then, oddly, when he came to sell it, he sold it on the open market, but oddly, the buyer was Kevin Godley.
Yes, 10cc.
And then Godley.
Sure.
So, sort of a kind of pop connection there. Now, then Kevin Godley decided to move away. Mm-hmm. And who comes along to buy the property but Vince Clarke? So there's a sort of generation to generation passing on of this property. But what Vince Clarke did was immediately knock Tara down.
Oh.
Yeah. He didn't have much sense of nostalgia there. No. But he built this new house, and it's quite controversial in the local area over here. Mm-hmm. It's called... anybody can sort of Google it if they wish. They'll find sort of some stories about it. It's called Ammonite, as in the fossil, mm-hmm. Ammonite. And it's a really bizarre structure. It was architect-designed, but it's really weird if you look at it. It's all kind of concrete circles and glass spirals and steel and glass staircases. I must say I'm not sure about it at all, if any of the... listeners go and have a look at it. It's apparently Vince Clarke has a kind of phobia of 90 degree angles.
is this a fact, or are you
not a gag, it's a fact. He's doesn't like corners and 90 degree angles, so that's why the house is all circles and bends and spirals.
So look, I think we're developing a later feature here, aren't we, of pop star phobias, aren't we?
we could come back to that one.
Yeah.
That's absolutely true. And because the sort of end of the story is that because it is such a strange structure, he's been trying to sell it because, as so often when pop stars relocate, Cherchez la femme, there's a woman involved. Mm. He married his USA publicist, Tracy Hurley.
Oh, right.
And they've got a son now. And they're now in America, in Maine, in fact.
Oh, right.
And so he wanted to sell this house. Now, it's taken 8 years for him to sell it.
Yes.
he sold it last year. And it was originally on the market for $2.5 million.
Right.
And certainly it went for less than $2 million. They had to keep dropping.
So,
yeah, it's worth having a look for it on, I don't know, Google or Google Images or whatever. Ammonite, Vince Clarke will find it. Because it's a very strange structure indeed.
Presumably he sold it to, what, the bass player from the Fratellis or something, has he?
Wouldn't that be great if he had? Find out who's there now. It's sort of going from generation to generation.
Yeah. Oh, well, now we know exactly what happened to Erasure, and I feel fulfilled. My quest is at an end. And I look forward to this Tomorrow's World album, because I was listening to a particular track. You know, when you're listening to an artist on your MP3 player in your car, and you're going through their back catalogue and enjoying it, and then you land on one track and you think, good grief, I had forgotten this entirely, and how magnificent it sounds. So you give that one two or three plays back to back just to sort of make up for lost time. And Erasure's Drama, which I think was on the Wild album, cropped up. Excuse me, and that was just that just stood out to me. I think it was a single as well, and I gave that one a whiz through two or three times. That is terrific. So if anybody is moved to dig out their Erasure collection later on today, then go for that one. What a great single! There's some chanting at the end. They keep chanting "Guilty," and I believe they went and fetched Jesus and Mary Chain out of the studio next door to do that chanting. So. There's a bit of rock minutiae for you. Anyway, Erasure, good. Yeah, we wish them luck. I was watching a show on Channel 4 earlier this week. I think it was the second episode. It's called Four Rooms. Have you seen that?
I haven't, but I've heard about it. It's where people try and flog off antiques or something, is it?
Yes, it is a sort of postmodern Antiques Roadshow, I suppose. Or where the Antiques Roadshow is very warm and cuddly and rustic. Four Rooms is more or less the same sort of show, but it's in this very stark minimalist room with a table in the middle. Maybe something you'd see in Vince Clarke's house, perhaps. And there's four doors surround this table, and somebody comes in and they say, "Look, I've got this," and it's. They don't tend to go for the Clarice Clift type of antique. They tend to go for, well, in the episode I watched, somebody had a Gilbert and George signed flattened gin bottle. So it's contemporary stuff. And then they can choose which order they go through the doors to meet the dealers, the collectors. And but if they come out of that collector's room, they're deemed to have foregone the offer. So you're sort of gambling against the odds that the next offer will be higher, and obviously if you go to the fourth room, that's the one you've got to accept because you've rejected the other three. That's the premise. So they'd had the Gilbert and George bottle, and the lady who had that took a bath, actually, because she rejected, or she didn't go and see one guy. She accepted an offer and didn't go and see a further guy, and he would have given her 2.5 times as much. So. But the next guy who came in brought in, what do you think, D.D. Ramone's bass.
Wow.
Yeah, he brought in D.D. Ramone's bass, and he had all the provenance. He had an email from the Ramones erstwhile manager saying, yep, I remember the gig. Because what happened is the Ramones had been on stage somewhere in London. He did mention where. Maybe the Roundhouse, perhaps. And D.D. broke a string. His roadie came on and handed him his a restrung bass, or his backup bass. And instead of handing the bass with the broken string back to the roadie, he handed it to the front row of the crowd.
Okay.
And this fella lunged forward, took it by the neck, and then scampered back off to his car and put it in the boot. hence, he had D.D. Ramone's bass, and he told this story, and it was really good. And he got a publicity photo of D.D. with this self same bass strapped to him. But, and this was the interesting thing, he was offered top whack. He was offered £1,200, and as he quite rightly pointed out, that this particular bass is about £1,100 in the shop, brand new, with no Ramones connection. So, he trolled off back, didn't accept any offers, and said, you know, they're frankly taking the wee-wee here. But that set me thinking about rock memorabilia, and I thought, have I got anything from any bands? And in light of the fact that Didi Ramone's bass will only fetch you £1,200, and you could buy your own bass for around about the same amount, have I got anything that would ever be worth anything? Well, the answer was inevitably no, but it did make me think, what have I got around the house? And I thought, I'll ask Terence the self-same question. So I have got many things. I've had set lists. I used to have a lot of set list rips.
Oh, I've got
them. Yeah, ripped from a monitor, which I haven't really got anymore. Either in house moves and things, they've disappeared. But so I really could only think of two things. One was, and this is never going to fetch more than a disparaging glance, I don't think. But I have Stan Stammers, who was the bass player in Theatre of Hate and Spear of Destiny. I have his orange juice carton.
Okay, good one, yeah.
Off of his bass amp, and I was watching Spear of Destiny, and I must be going back now to 1983, I would have thought, and they'd gone off stage, and I was hanging around at the front while the crowd dispersed, and a roadie came on, and I said, give me something off the stage, and the roadie said, what? I said, anything. So he gave me an empty orange juice carton off Stan Stammer's bass amp. I still have that.
A niche market for that, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, obviously would fetch a fair price with the pockets of Stan Stammer's fruit beverage collectors out there. So I'll hang on to that and watch it appreciate in value. The other thing I have is maybe a little bit better. This I have the shattered drumstick from the drummer. Have to Google the guy's name at some point, but the drummer from Muse, I have his shattered drumstick.
Okay.
Yeah, sitting next to my internet router, actually, upstairs. And he cobbed that into the crowd at a V festival, and it landed near enough for me to grab it. So.
I think you should increase your house contents insurance.
To cover just those two items, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. I keep everything. I'm terrible for this. About once a year, I have a kind of weeding out session and promise myself I'm going minimalist. Mm-hmm. And I generally do, the place is some very tidy and is minimalist. But I have a couple of very big, virtually walk-in cupboards where I just have quite neatly stacked boxes and boxes of stuff.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Just followed me. Yeah,
no, that's really good. That's really good.
I keep everything. So
so you've got like Lemmy's underpants.
I'm going to give you some examples. I pulled out one box, and out of that box I pulled out a couple of folders, and I'll whiz through these. I've got about 10 examples.
Right.
And bar one or two, they all have a story to them, and of course we don't have time, but I think if we ever need to come back to any of these, there's a story attached to all of them. I've got various set lists as well, but as I say, I spent much of my adult life working in the pop rock media biz.
So you did.
So yeah. So I've got Soft Boys set lists coming out of my ears, handwritten by Robin Hitchcock.
Excellent.
From the Hope and Anchor and the Greyhound.
Yes.
And for them.
Yes.
I've got a range of scribbled notes from Joe Strummer. I picked one out here. There's one that says, in terrible writing, £1 advance, it says, £1 advance of 101ers at Dublin Castle.
Fantastic. That is genuinely worth something, if not financially, sentimentally. That is a terrific thing to have. Yeah.
Definitely. I've got signed photos of lots of people. Too. Like the first two I picked out, Sarah Green of Blue Peter.
And so, presumably, she was sat next to Joe Strummer while he was writing the billet for the 101ers gig.
That's right. Much of his works were dedicated to Sarah Green.
Yeah.
Elvis Costello signed photo. I've got a piece of paper saying in big letters with a ballpoint pen, but scribbled really harshly and made very thickly, saying "Keep out." And that was written by Spike Milligan.
He's not having a good day. I'm guessing
he He was not. And that was very often on the tour I was with him on, and that was put on his dressing room door.
Exactly.
And that was the only note he had on his door, was one saying, keep out.
Well, and I think that there lies a decent philosophy for life, really. Is it?
Yes.
A harshly scribbled biro note saying, keep out, pinned metaphorically to your entire life is not a bad way to go through the world, perhaps.
You can see the angst in the kind of harshness of the pen strokes. I've got a Dandelion Sampler album given to me by John Peel.
Oh, marvellous, yes. Yeah, yeah. Great.
There's a story behind this one. I've got a thank you letter from Charlie Cray.
Really? And he was the less famous of the three brothers, wasn't he? He was
their elder brother.
Yeah,
yes.
And he was a slight little guy, wasn't he? He didn't look like the other two, did he? Or am I wrong there?
I think you're a bit off.
Okay.
He was quite a stocky fellow.
Was he? Okay.
I had a very small part in the movie The Krays.
Yes.
From 1989. And Charlie Cray, for reasons which would fill up an entire other podcast, was taken on as a consultant for the film, which was really just a way of giving him some money to keep him quiet.
Yeah.
Some might say
you're
led.
Yeah.
And he got chatting to me, and he was on set all the time. And anyway, there's a story behind it all, but I got a kind of thank you letter from Charlie Cray.
Very good, yeah. I know who'd buy that off you. One Stephen Patrick Morrissey would buy that from you.
Would he indeed?
He's obsessed with the Krays, of course, isn't he, Morrissey? Yes. Yeah.
I could have a good chat with him about my time in the company of Charlie Cray.
Indeed.
A letter from Stefan Grossman, who was a contemporary of John Sebastian. He was in the early... what was John Sebastian's band's name? Loving Spoonful.
Oh, yes.
He was in the early version of Loving Spoonful. I've got a letter from him written in French. Story behind that as well. I just pulled out, I've actually got the folder here, a letter confirming my appointment. I forgot I had this job. I seriously had forgotten I ever had this job. It was to commentate on cricket for one summer for British Telecom.
Oh, was it really? For British Telecom? Or over the telephone?
Yes, sort of like a dial in and you got cricket commentary. And I was... I was on that with Middlesex. That would have been
remarkable.
I'd forgotten I did it.
A service which would have no place whatsoever in the modern world.
Absolutely none now, but it was really popular. Of course, it was. I can't remember what you paid then. I think it was just the cost of a normal caller.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
And it was largely for people at work who weren't allowed to have a radio or whatever.
Yeah. Good point. Yeah. And funnily enough, I used to work many years ago for a radio station which was only available on the telephone.
Really?
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Financial catastrophe, you might imagine.
I can imagine, yeah. Well, the cricket thing, they expanded too far. It was fine for sort of international matches, but what they did was they then started offering commentary for all of the county cricket games. And I know you're not a big sports fan, but as today and as then, county cricket is, again, what we referred to the word earlier, a niche market.
Yes.
It's a niche market. Quite often you can have, you get these sports reports and it will say, well, today Sussex declared at 423 in the match with Middlesex at Hove. And you think, oh, it's on the news, you know. But in actual fact, there's probably only about 30, 40 people there on a quiet, sort of drowsy, overcast Tuesday.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, if only, such a small number of people would actually go to the ground, the number of people actually dialing in to hear live commentary on... Derbyshire, against Essex on a Thursday afternoon was quite small.
Yeah.
it was a short gig.
Well, much the same as this radio station over the telephone. I said the absolute bulk of the time was spent broadcasting to absolutely nobody, because nobody really wanted to listen to the radio on the telephone. And some poor sap, not me, actually did overnights.
Oh my God, that's the graveyard. That is the graveyard shift, isn't it?
Yeah, but he loved it. He loved it. He didn't really care that nobody was listening. He loved spending the entire night in a radio studio, and that was enough for him. So God bless him for that. Yeah. Well, that's a fantastic collection. That rather makes my Muse Drummer's Stick and Stan Stammer's Theatre of Hate's Orange Juice look somewhat embarrassing, but that is terrific. And you must, of course, hang on to all that stuff.
Oh, yes, yeah. I do. They're the things I don't get rid of. Actually, well, I'll just tell you quickly. I've just realised I've got one more thing here. I know the time is short, but actually...
Please.
This is interesting. It's, he says... No, it's a handbill from the Jazz and Blues Festival at Windsor, 1967.
Was that the first one?
No, it was the seventh.
Oh, was it really? Good Lord.
According to this handbill, yeah. And it's more of interest just for who was on the bill. Remember, it's August 67.
Yes.
Now, it ran over 3 nights. Well,
I'll tell you what we should do here, Terence. I should try and guess who was on the bill.
Okay.
Let me have a go. I won't do well, but I think this might be an interesting experiment. And
okay, great.
I'm always prone to making an oaf of myself, so let's have a go. I'm thinking, so 67. Now,
67.
And it's the Jazz and Blues Festival. Now, the Jazz and Blues sobriquet became fairly flexible, to say the least, didn't it? It wasn't by then restricted to jazz and blues.
Don't concentrate at all on jazz or blues. In fact, ignore jazz and blues.
That's what I thought. So I'm going to say Hawtwind were on.
Nope.
Ah, they were on one of those. Perhaps not that year. So I'm thinking maybe the Soft Machine were on.
You're sort of peppering the target. Yeah. You're the right sort of people, but they're not.
Pink Floyd?
Yes! Wait for this. Yeah. This is one of the reasons I wanted to mention this. On the Saturday, the Pink Floyd, here, were supporting on the underbill to the top of the bill, Paul Jones.
Solo Paul Jones.
Solo Paul Jones, I suppose, later or had just left Manfred
Mann. Well,
and underneath Pink Floyd, The Crazy World of Arthur Brown, Amen Corner, and 10 Years After, right at the bottom of the bill.
Yes, interesting. But imagine you think, I've got some artists lined up for my little do here. I know what order I'll put them in. That's Bloke Out of Manfred Mann on his own, followed, preceded by Pink Floyd.
The Pink Floyd.
Remarkable.
And now, that tickets for that were 15 shillings, which is 75 pence.
Wow.
And on the Sunday, it was split. They had a matinee show. And you could come for the matinee show between 2:30 and 5:30, tickets 7 and 6 pence,
which
is like 30-something pence. And... You had to clear off at 5:30. They expected you to shove off.
And how would they police that?
I don't know. I have no idea. Top of the bill in the afternoon show, Donovan.
Yes.
And supported by a load of people we would never have heard of, but also Al Stewart.
Who sort of contemporaries of each other. I mean, obviously they were on the same bill, but sort of had a similar flavour, didn't they, Al Stewart and Donovan?
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, the big finish, Magnus, Sunday evening, after you'd shoved the matinee crew out, from 7 o'clock till 11:30, 15 shillings, top of the bill, The Cream.
The Cream, yes.
The Cream.
Yes.
Underneath, next in ranking, if you like, second last, Jeff Beck.
Yes.
Inevitably, P.P. Arnold, who would always... Next, down the bill, we're going down the bill, John Mayall.
Wow, yeah, underneath P.P. Arnold,
Underneath there, underneath John Mayall, Chicken Shack.
Wow.
Underneath Chicken Shack, Denny Lane and Strings. But two more big things I'm going to... I'm going to say the bottom of the bill first, which was The Pentangle, with Bert Jansch, John Renbourn and Jackie Machine.
What was this thing about putting the definite article in front of every band?
So they're very keen on it here.
If Hawkwind had been on, they would have been The Hawkwind, wouldn't they?
They would have been. But second bottom of this lineup on Sunday the 13th of August 1967, the debut of Peter Green's Fleetwood Mac.
Oh, really? And they were bottom of the bill?
Second bottom, the Pentangle were bottom of the bill.
Wow. So you've got Pink Floyd supporting Paul Jones, and you've got Fleetwood Mac bottom of the bill to who was top? Donovan, was it?
The Cream.
Oh, The Cream, of course. Yes. Yeah. Good. Wow. Yeah.
And just in a contrast to modern sort of festivals, it was at Balloon Meadow Royal Windsor Racecourse, and this is what it says for the added attractions. And by the way, there was a special late train service to Staines, Twickenham and Waterloo.
Well, quite right too, yes.
The special attractions are listed in one little box.
Okay.
It says, the, you know, to add to the atmosphere, marquees, campsite, car park, licensed bar.
Yes, it's like you, yeah, your side attractions include some canvas, some asphalt.
Yeah, yes. And a bar. That's it. So, yeah, that was the Windsor 1967 Jazz and Blues Festival. And, as we say, a sturdy and amazing contrast to what we would see in today's environment.
Yes, yeah, you almost expect to see, you know, also appearing clouds and grass, don't you? Yeah, no, but that doesn't take you back. And I got a picture in my head that the stage was little more than a half hundredweight of scaffolding and some planks.
I imagine you're right. Stage not pictured. The handbill is all sort of purple and blue.
Wow, how fantastic. Yeah, that's brilliant. Well, talking of festivals, of course, as we're speaking now, there is a little gathering going on somewhere in the depths of Somerset, which seems to be on the telly quite a lot. It's Glastonbury weekend, of course. And what are you making of it this year? Has something changed? Has some of the sparkle and magic gone away? Or is it the glorious beast it always was?
I'm so far, I must admit, that the magic has gone. The mystery seems to have gone altogether now. Glastonbury, it's all over the TV now, and of course you don't need Wellingtons in your sitting room. I watched U2 last night.
Oh yeah, I did. Yes.
I'm not one of these virulent anti-U2 people that are currently cropping up all over the media, but I'm not a big fan either. I just found it incredibly flat and dull. I mean, they're getting good reviews in some of the papers today, including The Guardian has gone a bit overboard. U2 at their fiercest and most urgent.
Oh, really?
I
didn't pick that up at all either. No, I think what was... A couple of things were clear to me. One was, I don't think Bono's in the best of health, to be perfectly honest. I know he's had this back surgery, which means he can't climb things anymore. And he can't. he had a propensity to climb things, didn't he? And wave flags from the top of whatever he climbed. But he can't do that any longer. He's got a load of metal in his back now. But also, I don't know if he was carrying a cold, but he was a good half octave lower than his usual register on all the numbers, and the stuff off Achtung Baby is sung almost falsetto. A lot of it, The Fly, if you think of the track The Fly, he didn't go for the falsetto, so obviously he was battling with his voice, and that became clear in the interview afterwards as well. So, you know, clearly the odds seem to be stacked against them, but despite all that, I mean, some bands will therefore bring their A-plus game, won't they, and really let rip if they know they've got something to overcome. But it seemed like they took their foot off the gas from the word go, really.
It felt like that, didn't it? It felt a bit like a rehearsal. And but I always have a problem with not just U2, but bands that have a singer who doesn't contribute on an instrument, because, let's face it, when Bono picks up that guitar, he's not really adding much. When they're live, I may be alone in this, but I find same with Led Zeppelin, The Who, and in this case U2, where you've only got one guitarist and he hasn't got a rhythm guitarist or at least a keyboard player with him,
sure,
he has to carry the whole weight of the sort of melody and the drive. I know a problem with the drum bass combo, mm-hmm, Adam and Larry. You know, they're very sort of tight and obviously played together for so long. That's not the issue, but as a live act, it sounds very thin, because you've just got the oddly named Edges guitar.
Yeah.
And it's always a very trebly, high guitar. There's no sort of floaty notes, there's no lower notes. It's very, very much on the high register. and there's nothing with it.
No.
It just sort of, I find that makes for a very thin sound.
Yes, line. Yes. And I don't know if you're aware of this, a little fact about The Edge and his guitar stylings is that he has no fewer than 3 guitar technicians under the stage mixing and adding effects to his guitar as he plays. So there's four people playing that guitar, essentially.
Yeah. Which I think that actually highlights the point that you probably wouldn't need to all that. They're playing the role that would be undertaken by an additional member.
Just bung a rhythm guitarist up there with him. Yeah, which is what my favourite. My favourite guitar player is Dave Gilmour, but up there with him for me is James Dean Bradfield from the Manic Street Preachers. So I think he's a wildly underrated a musician, whether you like the band or not. He's absolutely storming and carries the band when you go and see them live. There's no doubt about it. But he is complemented almost in the wings, but not quite, by some callow youth strumming a rhythm guitar. And that's no cop-out. He appreciates that he needs a road to drive on, really, and that's what this little guy's doing. So and they always come across terrifically live. So, yeah.
Absolutely. I think, that's the perfect sort of antidote to the U2 dilemma, I think. I think James Dean Bradfield couldn't agree with you more. I think hugely underrated guitarist, singer, and writer as well. I think he's absolutely master of his craft.
He is.
But as you say, possibly allowed to have that freedom live by the essence of the that extra.
That's right. Metal. And that's no great shakes to you too, is it? Even bung somebody in the wings, even have a guitar track. Running through the desk digitally, if you must. Yeah. And they did. It was, almost like watching them, not quite sound check, but run through the sets before doing the big gig proper. So that's what it felt like to me.
But I think generally the reason that Glastonbury has kind of gone down in our ratings a little bit. The number of festivals, of course, in the last few years has just mushroomed.
Well, yes. Yeah, indeed.
And, of course, they all adopt the Glastonbury format as well. You get sort of the 3 nights, the theme bills, main stage, alternative stages, comedy tent, acoustic tent, children's area, as in contrast to the Windsor Festival from 1967.
But, yes.
And I think the kind of dangerous edge and the slumming it kind of aspect of going to Glastonbury disappeared behind the metal walls and the security cards.
And it's harder to secure tickets for that than it is for the men's 100 metres in 2012, isn't it?
I think it is,
I was speaking to somebody just the other weekend who, and this is quite telling, went every year religiously to Glastonbury and this year just couldn't summon up the enthusiasm. And she said, oh yes, what you have to do is back in March sometime is register your interest in having a ticket.
Yeah.
And then submit a photo. If you clear that process, they ask you then for a photo and your ticket has your photo on and da 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 da. And you kind of think, this isn't exactly pulling up in a field in a converted council bus and smoking Chillums listening to 10 Years After, is it?
No, it's a bit of a faff, isn't it, to be honest?
Yeah. So, perhaps every dog has his day, and perhaps this year Glastonbury is either having a bad year or everybody is just a little fed up with Glastonbury, or maybe that's just us old folk, I don't know.
Yeah, well, when I've been, I love the atmosphere and the buzz, but I think you're right. I'll trade all that now for a nice sit down.
Yeah. Yes, which of course you can do when watching it on telly, and it's a far more sofa civilized process. Yeah, so we'll see how the rest of the weekend progresses. There might be some storming performances yet to come, and we've still got Bianchi, haven't we? She's still
Bianchi, yeah.
and who's closing on Sunday night? I completely forget now. Yeah. Yes,
I've forgotten too. How awful. Yes. We'll maybe reflect on that next week.
Yes.
Last week you were telling us that it was your big debut on Trent Sound, and I was just going to ask you, as we close, how it went. It must have gone quite well because they asked you back for a bonus Thursday afternoon.
Yes.
Session.
That was more to do with the afternoon guy having to take his mum somewhere.
Now, look, you shouldn't have said that. You should have said, well, you know, the calls just came flooding in, the emails, and, that, you know, the demand was so great, they had
to find me back. Yes, no, the afternoon guy called me the day before and said he had a bit of a family emergency. And so, exactly. So there I was for a second time on Wednesday afternoon. Or actually, it was Thursday afternoon.
It was Thursday, yes.
Such has been my week. Well, yeah, no, the first thing I'd have to say is I thoroughly enjoyed it. Whether the listening public felt the same, I really don't know. I've had one or two people contact, but they're the sort of people who, i.e. family and friends, who would have said it was good even if it wasn't. But
I thought you were going to say they were lawyers.
Yes, and though I never open emails from lawyers. But based on my own experience, I thoroughly enjoyed it. I haven't done any radio for a long time, felt that I slid back into it fairly comfortably and had a thoroughly enjoyable time. The modern radio studio has changed out of all recognition, really. I think some people certainly imagine that you're sat surrounded by piles of CDs and bits of paper. The bits of paper are still there, but of course there are no CDs and certainly no vinyl. Everything is loaded into a computer. All the jingles and all the news cues, and of course all the music is on a computer, which makes life very easy. And I think where once upon a time you were operating what, 7, maybe 8 faders in a radio studio, you're now operating a single fader and one supplementary one to open to bring the news in. So life is very simple and easy in the radio studio. And I suppose some purists would say, well, that's taken all the technique out of it. But actually, it means you can contribute a lot more to your own show because you're not constantly trying to listen to stuff on pre-fade and tape levels and all those things we used to have to do. So that makes life a great deal easier. And that doesn't take long to get used to either. And being something of a thickie, and that must be a good thing. So I certainly enjoyed it. I'm doing another show this afternoon, so I'll be on www.trentsound this afternoon. Depending, of course, when you listen to this this podcast, but that's every Saturday afternoon, so whenever you listen to this, just pick the next nearest Saturday and I should be there. And it's going quite well. Perhaps, if I'm being honest, have quite a handle on at the moment is what exactly people want to hear from a radio show these days, and I'm trying to hone that down, but hopefully I'll get there.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, I heard parts of Saturday afternoon as I was making my way around. It sounded pretty good from here.
So bless you for that.
We all wish you well.
No, thank you very much. Yeah, and it will be. It is now available on iTunes as of yesterday. Not just my show, the entire station is available through iTunes as of yesterday, and we will also be on a thing called UK Radio Player, which is a little device that you can download and brings many, many feeds from all over the web of UK radio stations. So we'll also be on there probably next week. So I think once we're available on the handles of petrol pumps, we've kind of got everything covered. So day-to-day reference there. More importantly than anything else, I am having a good time, and that's all that matters. So do you have anything to add to our little exchange this week, Terence?
No, that's good for me. We're way over time.
Oh, of course,
so,
yes.
I'll wish you well with your radio show.
Thank you.
And thank you for the chat as ever, and goodbye till next week from me.
Yes, well, bless you for that. To mention on the site this week, available all week, we've got a lovely piece from Terence, which is about comedy. And there's a piece from our friend Joe Rivers, which is about watching Top of the Pops from before you were born. We've got the story behind the world's favourite posters. This is all off the top of my head, so I'm doing well here. and we've also got a clip of Glastonbury from 1971 with Quintessence playing there. And that's on the homepage. You can have a look at that as well. But until we catch up with you again in 7 days' time, that has been the Parish Council from the Rocking Vicar. And we wish you all a very pleasant week. Bye-bye.